Hi, this is Barry Lissett, Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. In recent months, climate change has played second fiddle to America's problems with the economy and healthcare. But now, new projections about a planet warming even faster than expected raise the question, how long can America and the world's powers wait to address global warming? In today's segment, we speak with Professor John Sturman, an expert in climate policy modeling at MIT. Professor, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
At a recent Informs conference, you began your presentation with a quote by Robert Louis Stevenson. The quote is, "Everybody sooner or later sits down to a banquet of consequences." What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what he meant, but I like it as an introduction to this question about climate change, because we don't see most of the impacts of climate change today. There are impacts today. It's happening now. It's not just something for the distant future. But the banquet of consequences that our children and grandchildren will sit down to will be all of the unintended consequences that accumulate as a result of the decisions we make, the policies we implement or fail to implement today. And right now, unfortunately, the banquet that they'll be sitting down to looks to be very sparse and strewn with conflict and strife, because the trajectory we're on is leading us to a planet that will be very inhospitable to humans and our civilization.
Let's look at a recent article in Nature that I know that you've quoted. What are the recent findings about the expected temperature change in the planet by the end of the century?
The IPCC projections from their fourth...
What is IPCC, report, please?
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So this is the consortium of the leading climate scientists, which shared the Nobel Peace Prize several years ago.
With
Vice President Gore. That's correct. So the IPCC is the organization convened under the UN, which consists of the world's leading climate scientists, and every few years they do a major assessment of the state of understanding of climate science, of impacts, of adaptation and mitigation options. Their most recent report was published in 2007, and under the scenario for emissions that best reflects what's been going on in the world, the projected temperature increase by 2100 was about 4 degrees centigrade, that's 7.2 Fahrenheit.
And what does a change in temperature of 4 degrees centigrade mean in practical terms for our listeners?
Well, I would strongly recommend people go look at the IPCC report. You can find it online in full. But at that degree of warming, and the uncertainty range is fairly large, but even at the low end, you get significant disruptions to the hydrological cycle, to the availability of water for drinking, for irrigation, for crops. You get significant melting of high-latitude ice, the Arctic ice, the Greenland ice sheet. You get significant disruptions to crop yields, especially in the poorer, less developed regions of the world. Significant fraction of all species are at risk of extinction. There's possible collapse of the Amazonian rainforest. There's rising intensity of storms, extreme weather events, both cold and hot, forest fires, droughts, floods, heat waves. And there's the possibility that various positive feedbacks kick in and carry us over a tipping point such that even if we reduce greenhouse gas emissions at that point, climate change would be, for all practical purposes, irreversible.
On the subject of being irreversible, the Nature article, as I recall, said that even the projections or the goals that major powers have set for themselves still leads to an increase in temperature. If our rosiest efforts would only slow global warming but not stop it, does that mean we should just give up?
So absolutely not, and you're quite right. So let's just back up one second. One of the things that we've done with our model, the C-ROADS model, which people can find at climateinteractive.org, is we provide an ongoing assessment of the impacts of all the policies that have been proposed by the different nations, different parties to the Framework Convention. So in the run-up to the Copenhagen Conference next month, different countries have made proposals or offered up what they might be willing to do if there were a treaty reached. We take all of those proposals, we aggregate them, we run them through our model, and just as you suggest, they don't get us anywhere close to where scientific consensus says we need to be, which is to keep the total warming below 2 degrees C. And right now it looks like in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 degrees by 2100. So we're very far away from having a set of proposals that are collectively sufficient to lower the worst risks of climate change. That's not a reason to give up. That's a reason to work towards bringing on the rest of the nations of the world whose participation is going to be necessary to reach such an agreement. So, for example, China has made no official commitment to reductions, although they have floated a number of ideas, including having their emissions peak by 2050. India has made no official commitment. Many of the other developing countries have made no official commitment, and the commitments from the developed countries are not aggressive enough to get us where we need to go. So we have much more work to do, and the good news is that it actually turns out to be much less expensive to reduce emissions, particularly in the United States, Europe, Japan, other developed countries, than we fear it is. Many of those opportunities for emissions reductions take the form of investments in efficiency, insulating buildings, improving the efficiency of appliances, of electronics, lighting, heating systems, automobiles. And in many cases, many studies have shown that those efficiency investments are not only cheap, but they have positive economic returns.
I haven't seen you weigh in on cap and trade. Have you done any analysis on that?
Well, so it's clear that the true cost of carbon energy is much greater than its market price. So we have a classic situation of negative externalities. And so it's important that we, through some means, raise the market price of carbon-based energy so that it more closely approximates its true cost. Those costs are real today, so we're not talking about raising the price of energy. We're just talking about raising the price that you see at the pump, instead of having it hidden in the defense budget, in health costs, in future disaster relief expenditures, et cetera. And so there's two principal ways to raise the market price of carbon to be close to its true cost, and those are a carbon tax and a cap and trade program. Many economists believe that a carbon tax would be simpler, more fair, less subject to political game playing. But in the United States in particular, it's not going to happen that way. And so the current legislation making its way through the Congress proposes a cap-and-trade program. And this has been done successfully in the past, most notably with sulfur dioxide emissions from power plants. So it's I think the current bills are imperfect. It's unlikely that they'll be passed in anywhere near their current form, if they are indeed passed at all. But it's urgent that we do something, and as we have in the past with, for example, the Montreal Protocol, which was the first agreement limiting the production of chlorofluorocarbons, the CFCs that destroy the stratospheric ozone layer, the original agreement was imperfect, and it has been amended, I think, more than a dozen times since then, getting better each time. So we need to follow the same trajectory here.
Which brings us to the question of the Copenhagen conference that'll take place in December 2009. What are you hoping will happen?
Well, what I'm hoping is that the parties will reach an agreement to reduce emissions that would be embodied in a treaty that would apply to all nations, not just the developed nations, that there would be broad-based participation, and that those commitments that each nation would undertake in that agreement would swiftly be ratified and implemented back in their home countries. That's the hope. Of course, what is likely is that there will not be such an agreement. There will instead most likely be, at best, national commitments that various parties agree to in the absence of a global agreement. But quite frankly, it looks the likelihood that the U.S. Congress will pass the Waxman-Markey bill or the Kerry-Boxer bill and have an actual signed commitment to emissions reductions before Copenhagen, that seems extremely unlikely. And without a commitment from the United States, there's unlikely to be any meaningful commitments by other nations. They look to us as the historically largest cumulative emitter of greenhouse gases to take a leadership role. And if we don't put some skin in the game, they're not going to be willing to commit to the reductions that are needed.
One of the problems is, in the United States at least, is a certain touchiness about the whole subject of climate change. And to bring it home, the Informs Journal Interfaces published a pair of papers about global warming, specifically about the threat to polar bear populations. The initial paper criticized research of the U.S. Department of Interior, saying that it didn't use sound forecasting methods. And by implication, the author suggested that forecasting about global warming in general is misguided. Would you care to weigh in?
Well, I think talking about polar bears a little bit misses the point. We do know that the public is very confused about the basic processes that that affect the climate. So we've done experiments here at MIT with highly educated graduate students, indeed our own students, which was published in Science last year, which showed that people were unable to correctly specify qualitatively a trajectory for emissions reductions that would stabilize the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And this is not an arcane issue. It's exactly analogous to understanding how water fills up your bathtub. So right now, today, emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are a little more than double the flux of CO2 out of the atmosphere. So we are filling up the bathtub of the atmosphere's CO2 at twice the rate that we're draining it out. And if you want to stabilize the concentration of those greenhouse gases at anywhere near a level that scientific consensus suggests would be necessary to reduce the worst risks of climate change, you have to cut those emissions very dramatically. You have to cut those emissions until we're putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere no faster than they are draining out. And that's a very straightforward conservation of mass balance issue. It's the most fundamental physical law we have, and 84% of the people that we tested failed to recognize that.
And that brings up something that you've talked about and written about. What is the problem with current understanding, both at the government level and among the public, when it comes to climate change?
Well, it's a complicated topic, but at its core, it's really as simple as filling up the bathtub and the most basic principles of risk analysis. So one mental model that many people hold, which is erroneous in this regard, is this bathtub mental model. They think that if we just stop the growth of greenhouse gas emissions, that will stabilize the climate. That's just not true. Another mental model that gets in the way here is the idea that we shouldn't do anything until there's no uncertainty, until there's scientific certainty about what the impacts are going to be. In plain terms, that's crazy. We all carry insurance on our homes, and not just because you're required to in order to get a mortgage, but because the risk of ruin if your home is burned down is so great that even though we don't know for sure that we're going to have a fire, we carry that insurance. So uncertainty is not our friend here, and it's not a cause for delay. It's actually a cause for greater concern because the impacts could be very much worse, and we might also get lucky and have the impacts be milder. But given that uncertainty, it behooves us to take out insurance, and insurance takes the form here of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. So that's another basic mental model that gets in the way. And the challenge here is to bring the science to the public in a way where the public can discover these things for themselves. I personally believe that even if the policymakers in Copenhagen understood all these things perfectly, and we have good reason to believe that they don't, But even if they did and reached a perfect agreement that dramatically reduced greenhouse emissions in time, that agreement in today's political reality would be DOA in Washington. It would be DOA in every capital around the planet, because there isn't sufficient grassroots public understanding and support for buying that insurance. So we have to, as modelers and as scientists in INFORMS and elsewhere, not only work with the senior policymakers and develop the detailed scientific analyses, but we need to communicate that in a much more effective way. And I believe that's going to entail a greater use of management flight simulators and other interactive learning environments so that people can experiment with the simulated climate themselves, test different assumptions, and gain a feel for how the climate responds in the same way that a pilot in an aircraft flight simulator gains a feel for how the aircraft might behave before they take it out in the real thing and face the actual risks.
I was going to ask you why we need what you call rapid flexible climate models, and I think you're starting to touch on it. What are rapid flexible climate models? And I think you're giving a little bit of a sense of why you feel they should be used.
Exactly right. So there's a large number of detailed and really very high quality climate simulations that IPCC and others use to assess what the impacts of greenhouse emissions on global mean surface temperature, on sea level, on other impacts, what they might be. These models are known as general circulation models or integrated coupled climate carbon cycle models. There's various flavors of them, but they are very detailed. They're very expensive to run. Their documentation is not always available in a form that a member of the House or Senate or executive branch could understand. And most importantly, the cycle time for running these models is very long. If you're part of the negotiations this year, more or less every week, and these days, about every day, new proposals are floated by one or another delegation to the negotiations, and you need to be able to assess what they mean. Furthermore, a lot of the proposals are presented in incompatible terms. So some countries present their proposals in terms of emissions reductions, in terms of tons of carbon per year, billions of tons of carbon per year. Other countries talk about per capita emissions. Other countries talk about the emissions intensity of their GDP, so how much carbon is given off per dollar of real GDP. The policymakers don't have any way to put all of these proposals on a consistent basis, and it's even more complicated because some of them talk about offsets and deforestation reductions and afforestation and carbon sequestration and so forth, and there's other greenhouse gases besides carbon dioxide. So a model that can deal with all that but doesn't give you results for weeks or months is not useful, and so we need models that can deal with all that in a rigorous, grounded, scientifically sound way but gives results instantly, and that's what we've developed. So our model, the C-ROADS model, the Climate Rapid Overview and Decision Support System, is completely consistent with the science, and people can go to the climateinteractive.org site and read the documentation and look at the report of the scientific review panel that evaluated it, and they can play with it, or at least a version of it, on their own and put in their own assumptions. And it gives immediate feedback. It runs on an ordinary laptop in less than a second, so you can evaluate a proposal that's floated by a country extremely rapidly. And when they say, well, this is what we're willing to do and it's going to be sufficient, you can run it through the model right then and there and find out whether, in fact, it is sufficient or whether, actually, no, that's not enough. The concentrations will continue to rise, temperatures will continue to rise, and sea level will continue to rise.
How did C-ROADS come to be developed?
There's a team working on it. It's a consortium of our group here at MIT at the Sloan School, the System Dynamics Group, with the Sustainability Institute and Ventana Systems. And the original model grew out of a doctoral dissertation by Tom Fitteman, one of my students, and has grown from there.
And are you getting any sense of whether either government officials or the public is using the models?
Yes, we've had a very good response. Last March, I gave along with Bob Carell from the Heinz Center, who's one of our partners, we did a public briefing in the Senate, which was introduced by Senator Kerry, who's a great fan of the model. last August, I briefed some of President Obama's energy, environment, and climate people down at the office of the White House. We've had a good response from other countries. The model is implemented in China now. There are other countries interested in using it. The European Environment Agency uses it. And all of that is helpful in reaching the policymaker side. Now, we have much more work to do, of course. But at the same time,
I assume you also want to reach business.
Absolutely. So that's exactly the next step. At the same time, it's not enough just to reach the policymakers because, as I said, even if they came up with the perfect agreement, it will never be ratified or implemented unless there's broad-based support for it in the business community, in civil society, and among the public. So we're also reaching out to those constituencies. We have a version of the model that's freely available on the web that anybody can use, and there are teaching materials that come with that. We've developed a mock Copenhagen negotiation role play that people can do with the model, and all the materials people need to run that themselves are on the climateinteractive.org site. So, and we know that people are, in fact, doing that. So it's been run in the U.S., in Sweden, in China, and Japan, a large number of countries.
And operations researchers thrive on data. What kind of data do you analyze with C-Roads?
There's the entire base of the accepted peer-reviewed scientific literature is available to us to help specify the model, calibrate it, test it, make sure it corresponds to the behavior of the large detailed models. We've chosen to calibrate the model to match the IPCC scenarios, even though we now know 2 years after the publication of their report that their results are over-optimistic. The reason for that is that a number of the key climate processes, particularly positive feedbacks that can lead to tipping point behavior in the climate, were poorly constrained by the available data at the time of their report, so they chose to leave them out. We now know better how those function, but our attitude is we don't want to get out ahead of the accepted science, so people can change those assumptions themselves, but in our base case, we maintain the IPCC. At least for now. And then in terms of outputs, the model generates the global concentrations of CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, and the other key greenhouse gases. And those can be and have been compared against the historical data and against the projections of the larger models to make sure that we're on track.
In your INFORMS presentation, you mentioned along these lines that C-Roads is more a sensitivity tool than one to precisely project CO2 and other emissions. For our listeners who are not in the technical field, can you explain the distinction and what they get from the model?
Yeah, a lot of times people believe that if you have a computer model of any type, that it should be able to provide a precise point prediction of what's going to happen. And that's generally not true in any domain of modeling. It's not true in economic modeling. It's not true in other forms of environmental modeling. It's not true in business planning. People need to understand that all models are approximations, all models are wrong, that they're simplifications and abstractions from the real system. And yet they can be tremendously useful. They don't provide a point prediction because there are many uncertainties. So every output of the C-Roads model is contingent on assumptions about future population and economic growth in each of the nations we represent, about the way the climate responds to forcing by greenhouse gases, the way sea level responds to warming. And all of those have some uncertainty around them. Our approach has been to make those uncertainties highly visible to the model user and to provide them with levers, which in the model take the form of sliders that you can actually grab with your mouse and pull. And you can put in any assumption that you would like to test, and then you see immediately what the impact might be. So in that fashion, people are able to get a sense for the response of the climate, but without having to accept in a black box fashion any particular set of assumptions.
And finally, what research are you working on now in the area of climate change that we'll be hearing about sometime in the future?
So we need to continue to develop the model in ways that can reach the public. We're obviously continuing to enhance it and deepen it with respect to the science as the science continues to evolve. But actually, the science is no longer the bottleneck to policy impact here and good policy decisions. It's the risk communication. It's getting the word out. And our model, I should stress, does not advocate a particular policy. It's not an advocacy model. It's a model that brings the science to users, anyone from head of state to a member of the public, in a way that allows them to see how the climate behaves as best we understand it, and to try any policies they wish. It's not up to us to tell people what emissions should be, but rather to give people the framework through which they can find out what the impacts of different policies might be. So there's a critical need to enhance the tools further to make them more usable, more friendly for ordinary members of the public, for kids in school, including middle school kids, who in our experience can get this quite well and find the model quite intuitive, and to connect better the impacts to what it's going to mean for us, where we live, and globally. So there's a visualization challenge, there's a risk communication challenge. On other projects, we have to drill down and ask, well, how are we going to actually do this? If people want to reduce emissions, what's the most cost-effective way to do it? How fast can we deploy the new technologies, energy efficiency? How fast, for example, can we deploy alternative fuel vehicles? So we have another project that looks at how to create a market for alternative fuel vehicles that is sustainable, not only ecologically, but also economically. And similar work going on at MIT with respect to smart grid, with respect to the built environment, etc.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Professor John Sturman of MIT. Professor, thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. For more information about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.